This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is Recode Media with Peter Kafka. That is me coming to you live on tape from the Jersey Shore. Delighted to have Shira Ovide from the New York Times coming to us, I think, from her coat closet in Queens. Welcome, Shira.
Thank you. Yes, live from my coat closet.
Thank you for crawling into the closet to make this podcast.
I even have a stool in here, so this is high tech.
I would expect nothing less from a technology columnist from the New York Times. I've known Shira for a long time because she used to work at the Wall Street Journal and wrote about tech and media there. And then she went to Bloomberg and had a column there that I sort of described as my favorite indie band because I thought it was awesome and I don't think enough people read it. And now she's at the New York Times writing about tech. So everyone reads her. Thanks for coming on. What's the name of your column and, more important, your newsletter that people are consuming?
The newsletter is called On Tech with Shira Ovide.
And comes out how often a week?
It used to be 5 days a week, and just recently it is now 3 days a week, and both
so
as an email newsletter, and it's published online at nytimes.com.
I want to talk to you about writing a newsletter and some of the mechanics of that, and we can talk about it at the end. But just before we dive into what you're writing about, do you have a sense of how big your audience is right now?
I have a sense, but I don't know that I'm allowed to say it out loud, so I will not get myself in trouble and say it out loud.
Okay. Let's put it this way. Who are you writing a New York Times tech column for? Is it for people who are deep into tech? Is it people who aren't interested in tech or are a little bit interested in tech?
I
have my thoughts.
Answer,
I'm curious what your thought is.
Yeah, I mean, look,
is.
I think ideally the answer is yes to all of those. You know, this was not my conception, but when some of the bosses at the Times and I talked about starting this new kind of newsletter, they conceived it as, you know, a kind of classic New York Times big tent kind of audience, right? So ideally, we want both people who don't think they're interested in tech and, you know, wouldn't know a TensorFlow from a, I don't know, I was trying to make a pun. I'll stop there.
I was going to say a RAM from a ROM, but that's really dated.
Something like that. Yeah. You know, people who don't think they're interested in tech, but obviously are smart, informed people and care about the world. And right now, understanding technology's impact on the world is part of being sort of an informed, educated citizen. And hopefully we're also reaching the people who care deeply about technology and sort of want to understand it better through my eyes.
I think you're doing a great job. Again, I'm a longtime fan. And also because people come up to me and go, hey, have you read Shira's newsletter? It's great. You should have her on the podcast, which is usually a good sign.
That's great.
That someone is
very
doing
glad to hear that.
Something great. So I want to talk to you about some of the stuff you've been writing about recently, and you've got a column out today. It's called "Why Can't Tech Fix Everything?" And this is a theme you've now taken a couple of cracks at, because I think you did one similar to this last fall, and I think you've laid out the thesis pretty well in the title. But tell me what you're trying to get at here.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that I've been struggling with, honestly, for most of the 16 or 18 months of the pandemic, which is, look, if you think about some of the sort of capital B big problems that we've had to face collectively in the last 18 months, things like this coronavirus pandemic, this reckoning about systemic racism, a highly contentious election and disputed aftermath. If you think about all of those things, tech was like tangentially important, if it was important at all, in all of those things, right? And so it's just made me think we've had a decade or so of technology promising to change the world. And in many ways it has, right? But is it really effective or impotent in these really thorny challenges that we're now facing collectively as citizens of the United States and the world?
So I like this column and this idea for two reasons. One is the meta part, which the technology columnist saying, tech, what are you going to do? Maybe not so much. But also because more practically, and you know, you and I are in a specific corner of the world, but we have the sense that this view is expanded beyond people we talk to, is that technology is everywhere and omnipresent, and it's in everything. And it does good things and it's in bad things, but it's fully baked in. And everything we touch has technology in it, whether we know about it or not. And in fact, a lot of what we're trying to do is to sort of understand how some of the tech we don't see is actually working, even when we're not aware of it. And there's also a triumphist, whatever adjective goes with triumphant, version of this, which is the Mark Andreessen view of the world. In fact, he just wrote about this when Andreessen Horowitz put out their new blog a couple months ago. The headline is Technology Saves the World, where he says, you know, the pandemic has proved specifically that the technology is great. It gave us the vaccines, you know, on all the standard things we've been reading for the last 16 months. It allowed us to keep in touch. It allowed us to waste our time when we weren't employed. It allowed us to do work, et cetera. What do you say to an Andreessen who looks around and says, no, everything that is good about this world and some bad stuff is coming to you from tech? That would have seemed to be kind of an edge argument a while ago. Now it seems like it's standard.
And you know what? I think Mark's right. You know, that thesis that he had, I can't even remember how many years ago, the software is eating the world thesis. I mean, I think he was largely correct about that it is true that and maybe this is sort of a sign of the success of technology, is that we now take it more for granted, right? Because it is infused in everything. And you and I, Peter, I know we roll our eyes at, you know, every company in the world describing themselves as a tech company, right? If you sell dog biscuits, somehow you're a tech company. But
if you lease office space, you're a tech company.
Yes, exactly. If you lease office space. But it's also, I mean, it's not entirely incorrect when companies say that, because technology is no longer this, you know, shiny thing that we take out of a box. It's sort of literally in the air that we breathe. It's infused in every molecule of our life. That does show that technology has successfully become an inescapable part of our lives. And it has, of course, allowed many of us to keep working and living and socializing and buying stuff and going to school and going to church and doing all these other things about life. And, you know, that is a victory of the power of technology. But again, if I think about these collective action problems, the things that are really thorny, if it's climate change or racial justice or healthcare, educational systems that work for everyone, or health, you know, a pandemic and healthcare, it just feels like, you know, this requires hard choices and smart, difficult policy decisions by lots of humans. And I don't know that technology is very good at helping tackle collective action problems.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, in the sort of first blush of Facebook and Twitter, there was this optimistic view that it was these things just by existing were going to help change the world, and you'd point to the Arab Spring. And now we obviously have a much more complex view of what Twitter and Facebook and the like do and don't do for us. There's still the Mark Zuckerberg argument that says, hey, there'd be no George Floyd racial reckoning if someone hadn't taken their cell phone and posted that video. I believe it was a Facebook video initially. And that's true too. Another version of this optimism comes from Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, who yesterday tweeted out that blockchain is going to unite America, a divided country. And then it said parenthetically, and then the rest of the world too. And the great thing about Jack is he's probably 100% serious. There's a 5% chance that maybe he's joking. But there still is very much a tech optimist view of the world that says that technology and humans' innate sort of capacity to help solve problems, you put those two things together, it will eventually win out, and eventually we get progress from that, even if we zigzag down the line. And I think you and probably I say, collective action you can't solve with tech necessarily. You can help. Tech can help it, but it can't fundamentally change human frailty. summing that up?
I think that's right. And honestly, I wish there were room to reconcile both our yours and mine kind of, I don't know, grumpy journalist pessimism of the world or realism about the world and the optimism that I think is real. I mean, I still remember that feeling when I first moved to the Bay Area after 2011. And it's not all fake, right? It's not just pointless greed dressed up as optimistic boosterism. I think there really is an optimism. There was an optimism, at least then, that these technology tools were positive agents for change. And again, that's true. But it's also true that every benefit comes with downsides. And, you know, I sort of have joked sometimes that I wish tech companies were required to hire chief pessimism officers, you know, like somebody in positions of authority whose job it is to basically say, well, what if that doesn't work? Or what if X happens instead? Mm-hmm. What if we're wrong? What's the worst that could happen? Is technology really the right thing? Should we do this at all, basically?
It's funny because I do think that there's a bunch of people who are involved in tech who are both ideological and very optimistic and have that this can go wrong attitude, but they often use that lens about government. So I was talking to some folks the other day about Apple and its effort to crack down on child porn by in part looking at what's on your phone, but not really looking at it. And their argument was like, this is a definition of a slippery slope. And no one wants children to be endangered. But once you allow Apple and or the government to look at your phone, you know, you can see where all this goes. And to them, this is like they're quite serious about it. Like, this is a very big deal and it's very dark. And they can see the downside of this immediately. Whereas I think some of those people would also have a hard time understanding how some of the products they make or use or run can have negative side effects. And to me, that's interesting. It's very clear to them to see like why government overreach is bad, but they can't understand why someone might have a problem with their tech being sort of largely unregulated.
Well, I don't know the specifics of Apple's policy decisions on these child sexual abuse images, but I'm sure there were dissenting opinions inside the company, and there was a vigorous debate about it. But, you know, I think the question is always how much of that emerges in the end product, right? And with this Apple thing, I mean, I was sort of captivated by Alex Stamos, you know, the former chief information security officer of Facebook, who had this long Twitter thread about the Apple policy, basically saying, look, there is this inevitable and difficult trade-off of encryption technologies that keep people safe and secure from prying eyes, either governments, if you're, you know, a dissident or somebody else who just doesn't want the government to peer into your personal messages, or if you want to avoid, you know, criminals and fraud and mm-hmm. other bad guys. And that there is an inevitable trade-off that you make messaging and any kind of web service more secure from prying eyes. It also invites abuse, including abuse by the worst actors you can imagine, child predators, terrorists, things like that. And what is the right balance? Can there be an appropriate balance between those two goods, privacy and public safety and security? And I think Stamos's point was basically that there's been this robust discussion in the industry about striking the right balance, and Apple just kind of opted out of that and did their own thing, right? And that may show something about the arrogance of some of these companies, that they feel like they're smart and that they're responsible for making their own decisions. And those things are true, but obviously there's a lot of expertise outside of those companies too. And even though it's slower, right, maybe that's the better thing to do.
Right, and then there's also who is gonna make these decisions? Should it be Apple by itself? Should it be Apple with a coalition of other computer companies? Should our elected officials have something to say about this? And, you know, I'm disappointed in my government all the time. But if I had to choose between the market setting, you know, letting it sort itself out and maybe elected officials that I have a say in putting in office or taking out of office, I'd like them to be involved as well. You have two other columns recently that get at sort of this push-pull that tech brings us. One is about Facebook and what is their real responsibility for the state we're in today. And the other is kind of similar. It's can you have innovation without hucksters? Let's talk about Facebook first. And again, I think the reason you're on is because I agree with all your opinions. But you're basically saying, hey, Facebook's responsible for a lot of stuff, but they're not responsible for everything. And when we make them responsible for everything, we take everyone else off the hook. You want to just spell that out for me?
Yeah, and I think this was specifically the specific piece you were talking about was about this tug of war with the White House over. Vaccine, misleading information about vaccines online, and to what extent. And I think there is a legitimate debate now, and there should be a nuanced view of why do people make the decisions that they make, whether that's about getting vaccinated with the coronavirus vaccines or about believing in this lie that President Trump was the rightful winner of the election. You know, I think it's easy and understandable to say, there's a bunch of garbage on Facebook or elsewhere online. It's either difficult or it's difficult to kind of tamp that down. And Facebook arguably hasn't done enough to do that. And so, I mean, nobody's saying it's all Facebook's fault, but I think Facebook bears, it takes a lot of blame. And again, some of that is deserved, but I do wonder if, you know, Rene DiResta, who sort of studies vaccine misinformation and other kinds of misinformation, talks about this like whole of society problems, right? That there's not like one bad tweet that makes you think, I don't need a coronavirus vaccine.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Shira.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
And we're back. It's Facebook and it's Rupert Murdoch, right? And it's Donald Trump. But is there something about 2021 and the fact that so many people are so resistant to getting a vaccine that can literally save their lives? And we don't recall having this sort of anti-vax debate about penicillin. I mean, obviously, there's always been people who've been resistant to this stuff. It seems like tech, if we include cable television and ways of disseminating that stuff as tech, then yeah, that is a tech problem. That's not just, I mean, maybe not just Facebook, but there is something about our information systems that makes it more difficult to get good information to balance out the bad stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think of it as an accelerant of everything, right? It's an accelerant of good information. These online communication tools where people can say, broadcast anything to billions at the push of a button. And it's an accelerant of bad information. And I just don't know if you can tackle a complex problem without looking at root causes about, well, let's see, if people have lots of good reasons to mistrust the healthcare system and government that feel like I haven't had healthcare and every time I go to the doctor, it costs me gazillions of dollars and the doctor treats me like garbage, or I've never seen a public health worker in my life, except now when they want something from me, right? You know, there's all kinds of root causes of mistrust in authority that don't get solved if you just blame Facebook. So I'm just saying blame Facebook and.
Yes. I mean, I think one thing, we had the version of this after the 2016 election, it must be Facebook's fault. Either because they misled people or they allowed the Russians to do it. This is Mark Zuckerberg's fault. We have Donald Trump. you know, I think one of the things that we're always very uncomfortable thinking or and certainly saying out loud is, you know who did this? Tens of millions of Americans decided to do this. And so if, you know, if you think they're all deluded or made a terrible decision, and I do, like, you have to live with that. And that's actually much more uncomfortable than thinking Mark Zuckerberg is doing evil things in California. It's that so many of your fellow citizens are so far apart from you in the way they view the world. And sitting with that is very, very difficult.
It is.
And it's much easier to point at Murdoch or Zuckerberg or blame your villain.
Yeah,
who are, by the way, villains.
Yeah, I mean, I will also give a shameless shout out to my colleague's book about Facebook. Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kong wrote this great book, An Ugly Truth, that digs basically into the last 5 years of Facebook, including the 2016 disinformation campaign. And I think, you know, even if you have followed that history, that recent history closely, in the pages of the New York Times and elsewhere, I think it's still illuminating about the ways that, you know, Facebook's choices really influence the world. And again, not just in the United States, but in Myanmar and in U.S. foreign policy and now in our healthcare policy. It's just, it is an enormous amount of power in the hands of really one person, right? Mark Zuckerberg basically is the de facto dictator of Facebook. And it's a lot of power in the hands of one man.
Yes, which he frequently says he doesn't want. He says, I don't want to be the decision maker.
Well,
I don't want to do this.
This is how we structured the company.
This is a government should be doing this. The Facebook Oversight Board should be doing this. And I get very frustrated with that argument.
He's not wrong. I mean, I do wonder to what extent some of the frustrations about Facebook and Google and Twitter and others is really a frustration with inaction by Washington, right? That we don't have a comprehensive federal privacy legislation, you know, that the members of Congress kind of hammer Facebook and Google and Twitter and others over what they perceive as shortcomings in taking down too much or too little content, depending on which side of the aisle you're on. And yet, you know, they haven't been effective in passing laws overseeing those companies. And that is their job. Their job is to sort of make guardrails around corporate behavior and that say, this is where the bright lines are. And they haven't really
I remain skeptical we're going to see significant change coming out of Washington for a bunch of structural reasons. But also, I just think that some of what we want to fix isn't fixable, right? Like, a lot of the anger about Facebook is that we find a lot of people believe they helped elect Donald Trump. But you can't create legislation, you can't create oversight that's meant to prevent Donald Trump getting reelected, right? That's not going to work that way. And a lot, you know, like, there's a lot of people who don't really care about privacy that much, or they might say they care about it, but that's not really the problem they're trying to solve. So we'll see. One more column topic, and then we can move on to more upbeat stuff. Innovation inviting huckster. And you, by the way, your columns are great. They're very readable. They're not depressing like this conversation might seem. Innovation, if you're going to have innovation, do you have to have hucksters? And my answer is yes, because you always have hucksters wherever there's money to be made. And if there's innovation, there's going to be money, and there's going to be money spent and money misappropriated. And why not participate in that? So you were thinking about the WeWork guys, and you were thinking about the guy whose name I forgot who said he was making electric trucks, but really was just a truck that someone was pushing.
Right. Trevor Milton, Nikola founder, right? It's, again, one of these topics that I sort of keep coming back to in various forms, but it's basically, we have created a system where there's a lot of incentives for entrepreneurs and companies to come up with the most ambitious idea possible, right? And there's financial reasons for that, right? There's way more money just sloshing around out there looking for places to invest than there are good ideas to invest in.
And they want world-changing ideas.
No one wants to invest in a better
ice cream parlor.
It's boring. Nobody wants to invest in a company that says, you know, we're going to make it slightly easier for hair salons to book appointments they say we are, I don't know, transforming the nature of work and hair. I made that up. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you know, there's a lot of financial and cultural incentives to be as ambitious as possible, right? And we can see the downsides of that. You get people like Adam Neumann at WeWork, who basically takes a office subleasing company and imagines himself as sort of president of the world, as somebody who's, you know, going to change the world's consciousness and, I don't know, own all the real estate in the United States and all the apartment complexes in the United States. Anyway, you get these people who dream too big and crash and burn. But I wonder if, you know, that same sort of quality where there's lots of incentives to dream the most ridiculous dreams possible, if that is also the same kinds of perverse incentives that do deliver real world-changing ideas. If, you know, Tesla and other electric cars and Google and Amazon, again, there are problems with all of those companies, but they are truly transformative ideas that at one point seemed ridiculous.
And there's a difference between saying, my company that sells books over the internet is one day going to be transformative and change the way all Americans do all their shopping and everyone around the world, even though you haven't built that yet. There's a difference between getting ahead of your skis and saying you something's coming, but it hasn't been quite. You know, Steve Jobs introduced the Macintosh in a national TV ad, but he hadn't finished building the Macintosh yet, which is for the problems of people making the Apple. Versus saying my blood testing company can test your blood for various diseases, and it just doesn't do that and never will. Right? One is a little bit of puffery. We accept that. The other is fraud, and you can go to jail for that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, there's a line between fraud and puffery, and Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, I think that's going to be the crux of the lawsuit about Elizabeth Holmes. But yeah, there is a line, but I wonder if the, you know, the incentives for the kind of way out over your skis, Elizabeth Holmes possibly allegedly criminal activity, if it's the same kind of incentives and mindset that also can deliver wildly successful good outcomes. And how do we get basically more of the good outcomes and less of the Theranos?
Or do we just accept that it's baked in?
Maybe.
And we'll accept a little bit of fraud and a little bit of money wasting. I mean, you mentioned WeWork. We had Elliot Brown, who wrote the great WeWork book with Maureen Farrell. And they show over and over, I mean, there's no one has accused that company of fraud. We all kind of assumed there would be some. And there was maybe some disclosure issues. But basically, everyone who was giving them money was eyes wide open. And if they weren't, it was their choice not to be eyes wide open. And the reason they went along with it is they thought there was going to be a reward for it. And they have incentives to do that. I'm sort of amazed, frankly, with the amount of money sloshing around that there isn't more outright fraud or stuff that's right up against the edge. And I've talked to various investors over the years, and some of them will say, there's more than you think. It's just that we don't really have an incentive to tell people about it when we figure it out. And I think there's probably a bunch that we don't see. But even if you account for that, you would think there'd be many more people who are outright scamming people. And instead, what we hear about is sort of think about scammers. We think about, you know, Nigerian email fraudsters and stuff like that. We don't think about people taking the piles of money that are sloshing around the valley and elsewhere and just absconding with it. And I'm shocked there isn't. I'm shocked there are not more Theranoses or fire festivals that we're hearing about left and right.
Yeah, I mean, good news, I guess. There could be way more scammers than there are.
It could be much worse. Let me ask you about how you're actually making the newsletter and what that creation is like. You talked about the idea that it's a big tent. Describe it to what you were doing at Bloomberg and what you're doing at The Times, because I think it's instructive.
I mean, I think it's just kind of a difference, a little bit of a difference of scope that, again, I think I have been basically a financial journalist for all of my career. And that is still the core of what I do and how my brain works, right? I think in terms of numbers and financial incentives and things like that. But I think writing this newsletter to The Times was an opportunity to think beyond the numbers as well, which was appealing. I mean, I did that at Bloomberg too, but I think this is just a little bit more of a tech through the lens of people and how it is shaping the world.
Like, he would include EBITDA in your Bloomberg columns.
Probably.
Has EBITDA shown up in a New York Times on tech newsletter?
I mean,
probably not.
I would hesitate to say no in case you find one example, but yeah. No.
I'm asking because I'm trying to do a version of this, and I find it pretty difficult often, in part because I think the business stuff is just fundamentally interesting, and it's one of the reasons I did it for many, many years. And I think avoiding talking about business is actually counterproductive. But do you find yourself going, oh, this is a really good story, but it's too niche or it's too specific? This is not a New York Times newsletter column.
Yeah, I mean, I think WeWork might be an example of that. Like, I wrote gazillions of WeWork columns at Bloomberg, and I think some of them were really good, and I was happy with them. But I haven't yet found a way to write about this sort of WeWork craziness and Elliot Morine's new book for this newsletter. I still may, but it does, these kind of... I do think about the why would readers, how do I make readers?
And you're thinking about it a lot. You're tweeting out literally page by page as you're reading it, and you're taking notes in the margins. So you're thinking hard about it.
Yeah.
And it does seem like there's something there for it. But maybe it's that there just isn't enough of a parable for you to tell. Is there a great topic that you want to get into a column and haven't? Is there another one like that where you haven't been able to figure out how to present it to a Times audience?
And to be fair, I mean, I think that sort of huckster piece that I wrote, the huckster newsletter that I wrote, was in part me thinking about WeWork and others. But yeah, other things that I haven't been able to, probably nothing that I want to say out loud because I will still want to do it. I mentioned a while ago in a newsletter that I wanted to find more ways to write about these sort of, I don't know what you'd call them, these largely unseen people who make the internet possible, right? Whether it's Reddit moderators or Wikipedia editors or, a lot of people have written about the content moderators at Facebook and other companies and some of the demands on their job. But, you know, there's all these people that salespeople who sell software. There's just all these people that we don't get as much attention as, like, tech engineers and product managers at big companies who are making it possible for the internet to exist as it is, right? And it might be like the person who manages your neighborhood next door group. And, you know, these people are the ones that really shape our experience online for better and for worse. And they probably don't get as much attention as they should.
I've talked to a bunch of newsletter writers over the last year, and that a lot of that is because of Substack and interest in sort of what they're making and who's funding them and what kind of topics they talk about. A lot of them will talk about feedback they get from their readers. Is that something you get from at the Times? Are people writing to you? Are you responding to them? Or are you at a scale where you can't even use an inbox for that?
No. We get quite a bit of reader feedback, and I think we try to reflect that. In the newsletter, we had a call out, this was last year, for readers' sort of favorite technology in the pandemic or otherwise. And I think people wrote in with some like really great and heartwarming responses. But yeah, I do admire the newsletter writers who I think do a much better job with community. Thinking about people like Ryan Broderick, the Garbage Day writer, who has sort of a Discord with other newsletter writers, but you know that's really like a tip sheet for him, and he features stuff that readers put into that Discord all the time. And I haven't been as good at doing that yet.
Well, I like what you do. I think the Times likes what you do because I think coincidentally they're going to announce today when you hear this podcast they're rolling out a whole new slew of newsletters. You describe yourself as a newsletter writer, sort of not a New York Times columnist. Does the stuff show up in print or in the sort of digital edition? Or is it only, can I only get it for a newsletter? I should know this.
No, it's both. I mean, it lives as an email newsletter that lives in your inbox. And it's also republished more or less verbatim every day on NewYorkTimes.com and selectively in the print pages of the New York Times.
And is that still a thing where all forms of media are equal, but getting in the print edition is still the thing that is the best and is what you're supposed to Instagram? Or have you been dissuaded from doing that?
I mean, I haven't seen a print copy of the New York Times since February 2020, so I certainly have not been Instagramming any New York Times print editions in which I appear.
That is the correct answer. All right, so here's to seeing you in real life in the same building, maybe across from a table, maybe very close to each other, and seeing print editions and all of that in the, I was going to say near future, but maybe medium near future. How about that?
I hope so, yes.
Thank you, Shira.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks again to Shira Ovide. By popular demand, we had Shira Ovide on. That's right. You could just ask to have people on and they will come on the show sometimes. It works great. You can try it. Thanks to Jill and Jelani for editing and producing. Thanks to our sponsors for letting us bring you this show for free. Thanks to you guys for listening and telling other people you like listening. This is Recode Media. We'll see you next week.